I've been on a bit of a tour the past couple weeks. I've been preaching in different churches in the diocese, providing supply for priests that need a Sunday or two off. I'll be doing the same next week as well, so it's good to be home for a little bit. But I have not been here since Advent began, and I did not realize that we are not doing the psalm. My sermon today is on the psalm. It's also the version of the psalm that you find in the prayer book, which is even more alienating for you guys. And I'm only going to pull from two verses, so it's a very short reading. Here are the verses. This is Psalm 85, verses 10 and 11. Mercy and truth have met together. Righteousness and peace have kissed each other. Truth shall flourish out of the earth, and righteousness shall look down from heaven. And I just want to talk today about how those two ideas of mercy and truth, or truth and righteousness, are one and the same in God. You can read the rest of the psalm later. There is a belief out there, you've probably heard, you might even believe it. The belief is that Christianity is a religion about love, and that doctrine divides. And that's part of it, but there's usually more to it. Part of it, this idea, is that... Is it cutting out in and off for you guys? Part of this idea is that because doctrine divides, there's something unchristian about doctrine. Christianity is about love, and so if doctrine divides, it can't be true doctrine because division and conflict are the opposite of love. Now, parts of this are very true. Paul tells us, for example, that tongues will cease, prophecies will cease, knowledge will cease, but in the end, only love remains. It is the highest virtue. It is the chief imitation of God. God is love, according to John the Apostle. And when it's all said and done, it's the only thing that will matter. But saying that it's the only thing that will matter is not the same thing as saying it's the only thing that exists. Love is not an abstract idea. It's a real relationship between persons. But part of being in a loving relationship involves speaking the truth. Liars are not lovers. After all, a friend is someone who will tell you truthfully when you have something in your teeth. So love is central. It's absolutely essential. But it takes all kinds of forms. And one of the ways that the church loves the world is through its teaching. Doctrine is teaching. And if that's true, then that means that when the church teaches true doctrine and not lies, then the church tells the truth. When the church teaches true doctrine to the world, then in that way, it loves the world. Now, probably nothing that I've said so far is very controversial. Everybody thinks love is good, and I think that most people would say it's a good thing to tell the truth. And it's a good thing to teach other people, right? People used to tell me all the time that my job, when I was a high school teacher, that this was the highest profession. And I could tell how truthful they were being because they always made sure I had the highest salary possible as well. My teacher friends out there will get that joke. Now, I could talk to you for a while about what I think is fair compensation for teachers, as well as what might be a fair expectation for the work that teachers should be doing. And everybody's got their own take on the issue. But I think there's one thing that we can agree on. There's a sense in which we put our money where our mouth is. If we really think it's important, then that's where we put our money. It's not a coincidence that in places where teaching and learning are really important, there's a lot of money being dumped into the schools. And in places where it's not, well, it's about what you would expect. So right, wrong, or indifferent, this is just a fact about how people use their money. They use it for what they value. And the nature of love is such that if a people value doctrine or teaching, if they think it's important, they put their money into it, because that's how they show their love for it. If you think something else is more important, then you put your money into something else. That's how it works. If you think, for example, that providing food for the homeless is more important, you put your money into that. And some people would say that the work of love that feeding the needy provides, or caring for the poor, is so important that there's no point in putting money anywhere else. Change directions for a second. As history has played out, the leaders of the church have not always agreed on what it should teach. Sometimes people like to say, can't we go back to the early church, the first century church, before it was all bogged down by doctrines and theology and controversy? So they turn to the church that you read about in the opening of Acts. Of course, that's a really interesting choice to look at. Because when you read about the church in the book of Acts, it's this utopian situation where the members of the church, they share all their property together and they just love one another. But then you also read that those people devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and fellowship. That means two things: that they were committed to being a part of not just any church, but the church that's connected to the apostles, that's in their fellowship. But even more notably, it says that they devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching. Teaching, of course, means doctrine. So if you want to be an early church Christian, then you need to be connected to the apostles' doctrine. Whatever else we can say about the first Christians and how much they loved Jesus and each other and even the poor, it looks like we can also say that the early Christians put their money into doctrine too. What's more interesting, though, is if you keep reading the book of Acts, you find that the early church was not as utopian as you might guess. Not long into the life of this spirit-filled community of believers, in the life of people who had first-hand experience of Jesus, not long into that, do you find division? The church was divided about what it should teach regarding Jews and Gentiles. Specifically, one of the first divisive doctrines that the church had to wrestle with was what it should teach about circumcision. That's a divisive issue. Under the law, every Jew knew that God wanted their male children circumcised as a mark of their belonging to his people. But now that the gospel had come, now that the Messiah had arrived, people were joining God's people that weren't Jews. They're people called Gentiles. What was the church supposed to tell those people? Would a Gentile convert need to be circumcised? Much more. Under Moses, Jews had been expected to keep certain dietary restrictions. Certain things that were marked as clean to eat and other things that were marked as unclean to eat. Were Gentiles who were devoting themselves to the Jewish Messiah expected to keep those same laws? Some people began to take sides on this issue and were making some pretty strong claims. We read in Acts that some of them said, if you don't get circumcised, you can't be saved. Naturally, this raises the stakes considerably for a Roman citizen who's interested in following Jesus. On the one hand, they're going to expect persecution from the emperor or their family if they converted. And on the other hand, converting to Christianity might require its own kind of violence if you were a man. You might be able to see why this doctrine became very heated. Now, the way the church handled this sets a precedent for how it would settle many other doctrinal debates in the future. They handled it through a council. And of course, that council was a public debate held by leaders of the church regarding what it should teach to the world. To those outside, it might be easy enough for those people to think that all this arguing was just divisive quarreling about theology. But for those present, this was nothing but a labor of love. A love for the Gentiles, a love for the unity of the church, and a love for the world by making its teaching clear. You can read Acts 15 later to find out what the church resolved. My only point here is that I want you to see that love and doctrine are not opposites. And I have another example. Jesus Christ is the Son of God. We say this sentence in the Creed every Sunday. If you want to look at the Nicene Creed, I'm just going to read part of it directly. It's one very long sentence. We believe in one Lord, Jesus Christ, the only begotten Son of God, eternally begotten of the Father, God from God, light from light, true God from true God, begotten, not made, of one being with the Father. Through him, all things were made. And most of you, if I asked you, do you believe this? Most probably would shrug your shoulders and say, sure, why not? Sounds good. But those words, those specific words, are the words of a doctrine that was not always agreed upon in the church. Those words are the words of a century-long battle within the church. Those words are in the Creed for a special reason, because those words stand against a certain error that plagued the church at one point. Those words are the result of the church's aim to stay in the teaching and fellowship of the apostles. Those are words written to make sure that the church preaches the true gospel to the world. Those words are written against heretics. And those heretics are called Arians. The Arians taught that when we say that Jesus is the Son of God, we mean that he's very divine. He's very like God the Father, but Jesus isn't actually God himself. Jesus, the Son of God, is begotten from God the Father, they would argue, and therefore he came into being after the Father. And so one of the common Arian sayings was, there is a time when the Son was not. And because there is only one God, one Creator, Jesus Christ, though very much like God, Jesus is not God in the same sense that God is God. And therefore, he is, like us, a creature. The Arians believe that Jesus was a creature, a special creature, but still only a creature, not the creator. Now, this was actually the majority view at one point in the history of the church. But what some leaders in the church started to see was that if this is true, then the church actually has no gospel. No good news to proclaim. Why? Because only God can save his people. If we budge on that, if we say that in any way a creature is able in their own strength to overcome death, if we say that, then we are saying that we don't need God to save us, that we can save ourselves. And if we say that Jesus was mostly God, but not completely God, then we're saying that he mostly saves us. Is that good news? Imagine hearing a sermon from Billy Graham where he explains that he wants to tell you some mostly good news. Good news, says the doctor, you're saved. Most of the cancer is gone. Would you drink water that is mostly mercury-free? Only 1% mercury in this glass. Is this the kind of salvation that we read about in the Bible? No. A bishop in Egypt saw this problem with the theology, and he led the fight to expose the error. A council was called in the year 325. It's called the Council of Nicaea. When the council ended, the church decisively resolved to begin speaking a certain way when communicating the gospel. When the church tells people who Jesus is, the church is clear that Jesus is eternal, that he is not made like a creature, but instead that he's the real deal, the real God, that he and the Father are essentially one and the same. Now, of course, this is the foundation for what Christians call the Trinity. It's a mysterious teaching about the being of God, especially in light of the reality of Jesus Christ. But what's important to realize is that it's a doctrine written in love. When you strip away the complexities of Trinitarian theology, you end up with something that sounds nice and simple. You get a nice, easy God, a God that fits your small vision of who he's allowed to be, but then you also strip away God's love. That is the essence of the doctrine of the Trinity. It's the church's work of explaining to the world that when God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, the church means to say that God gives himself, his whole being. He holds nothing back. At the end of Acts, when Paul is on his sea voyages to Rome, you read about a stop in a city called Myra in Lycia. It's a small fishing village in what's now considered Turkey today. Now, we don't know much from Acts about what interactions took place there at that port. What we do know is that less than 3 centuries later, that town has become a Christian town and had a Christian bishop who pastored people there. The bishop there, the Bishop of Myra, had a name. His name was Nicholas. He was a pastor who loved his people dearly. He was deeply involved in their lives. He prayed for them. He taught them the scriptures. He led them in worship and truth. He led them in how to live holy lives that befit the saints of God. And because of his great love for his people, and because of the great love that they had for him, he's been written about for centuries. Sometimes, after a while, those stories had a way of growing and getting bigger and more creative in their tellings. So we don't know everything about him. I just want to tell you 2 stories today that historians say are probably true. Here's the first story. Once, Nicholas saw a boy crying. When he asked the boy what was wrong, the boy explained that his father did not have any money for a dowry to give to the boy's sisters. If you don't know what that means, it means that the 3 girls did not have money to offer a prospective husband in marriage, which was the custom at the time. It also means that the end result of that is, in order to survive, they would need to become prostitutes. Nicholas prayed with the boy and his father. Then, in the middle of the night, Nicholas snuck out to their house and secretly dropped off 3 bags of gold through the window. When the family woke and discovered it, they rejoiced because Nicholas had saved the girls, though they didn't know that. The second story is shorter. Nicholas of Myra joined the Egyptian bishop that I had mentioned above in the fight against Arianism. We have historical records of him being present at the Council of Nicaea and of voting against the Arian heresy. There's a little bit more to the story, though, and part of this is historically, there's question marks. Some accounts say that Nicholas of Myra slapped a certain Arian in the face at the council, and some accounts say that it was Arius himself. To this day, the Orthodox Church, in their icons of St. Nicholas of Myra, show him punching Arius himself. I realize this one doesn't have the punch, but it's true. Now, that's a very long way to tell you that this historical person that we call Saint Nick, sometimes known as Santa Claus, today is the day of his death, December 6th. And so today the church remembers him and gives thanks for his godly life and example. Today is St. Nicholas Day. What I want you to see, though, is that this great man saw no tension between doctrine and love. He understood his calling was faithfulness to both. The God who calls us to care for the poor is not some lesser God among men, but is in fact the true God of love, who truly became one of us so that we could become holy like him. I have two practical things you can take away from this. Number one, Bill reminded you last week that this season of Advent is more or less a baby Lent. And in Lent, we seek to grow in love by depriving ourselves in order to be ready for the work that God intends for us to do. One of the ways that we keep a holy Lent is by devoting a certain amount of time to the sick, the poor, and the needy. Advent is an equally good time to start doing this as well. We have a number of ways that you can do this here at Redeemer. Not only are there ongoing efforts targeted at specific individuals in need that we've come to care for, there are a number of organizations that we're partnered with that we will connect you with. But charity isn't just about organized efforts, it is a daily practice. Our city's homeless population is growing rapidly and showing up with all their needs all around town. If you haven't met any of them, come get me or Bill. I'll take you over to Starbucks to meet some of them. Finally, remember that Saint Nicholas was as much a man about doctrine and truth as he was about love and charity. The Arianism that you heard about in the Council of Nicaea hasn't gone away. Today we have Jehovah's Witnesses and Mormons that are modern day Arians. And each of those groups have not gotten smaller in my lifetime. So educate yourself. Take and read. Learn the faith that is faithful to the fellowship and teaching of the apostles. This fall, I was able to meet with a couple members at Redeemer and begin reading the works of St. Augustine with them. And they have agreed to join me again in the spring to continue learning the doctrines of the faith. The bishop from Egypt that led the charge against the Arians, his name was Saint Athanasius. He helped write a lot of the words that you say that you believe every Sunday when you recite the Nicene Creed. We'll be reading his short book on the Incarnation. We're hoping to grow our group and have others join us. So let me know if you're interested and I'll get you some of that information. Our collect today says that God gave us the scriptures for our learning. Embrace that. Join us and St. Athanasius and St. Nicholas as we seek to hear them, read, mark, learn, and inwardly digest them, that by patience and the comfort of God's holy word, we may embrace and ever hold fast the blessed hope of everlasting life. Amen.